Let's start with a question. Not so many questions, actually probably just about right. And if you have any kind of follow-up questions or anything as we go along, please feel free to do so. Just grab the microphone and fire away. So we'll see what happens as we go along. So let's start from the beginning. And Venerable, please, if you wish to add anything, any time, you are welcome to add whatever you like to add. Yeah. So, good day, Ajahn. Okay. Okay. That's a very Australian thing to say. It's about to say in Australia, good day, good day, good day, Ajahn. Pertaining to Majjhima Nikaya 128, cause and condition. Dutulla, is this the same as Majjhima 64, sabbaso kaya dutulla nang patipasaddhya vibhicheva kamehe, etc. Is this the same one? Oh, now you're asking hard questions. Where are you? There you are. Okay. Quite possibly, because the one at Majjhima 64 is you overcome the five hindrances and also kaya dutulla. So it is the very last things that you overcome just before you enter samadhi. This is what the five hindrances really are. Sometimes people think the five hindrances incorporate, you know, all sorts of coarse hindrances, but that's not really the case, because when you look at the gradual training, the way the mind is developed gradually, you start off by sense restraint, and that already gets rid of the coarser hindrances. Then you have mindfulness and clear comprehension, which also keeps the hindrances in check, and only when towards the very end, just before you enter samadhi, do you abandon the five hindrances. The five hindrances usually is a reference to refined hindrances, and here kaya dutulanang patipasadaya vibhichavakame, whatever, this is a part of the form, if I remember correctly, is related to the formula for the five hindrances, yeah, just before you enter jhana. So it's part of that. And of course, Majjhima 128, the Upaklesa Sutta, also is about the refined hindrances as you enter jhana. So it is quite likely that they are related to each other, I would say. But I have never even considered this question before. I'd have to look at it carefully before I can give in a more clear answer. But I think quite likely that's the case. It's good. It's good to have students who are more awake than you are. So that's always always helpful. Okay. Dear Ajahn, what is your view on putting a pet down if it is in pain and the vet reckons there is no hope of recovery? This is an interesting question. It's a question that comes up kind of at every now and again. And Ajahn Brahm has a very nice reply to that question, which I think is may sometimes work, may not always work, but it may sometimes work. And Ajahn Brahm says you should ask your pet. Yeah? And sometimes we have a connection to our pets in a way that we can almost, we have a feeling for what the pet wants. Yeah, when you have had a pet for a long time, you have a connection to it, just like you have a connection to a human being. And so you have some feeling for what the pet actually desires. So you ask the pet, and then you kind of see what kind of response you get. Yeah, and sometimes you can kind of feel whether it seems to be the right time or not. So that is one way of doing it. And sometimes the pet may be ready to die, just like a human being. You had enough, you don't want to carry on anymore because it's just too much pain, too much suffering. Just like human beings sometimes would like to have euthanasia, the same may be true for pets. But if you cannot find an answer that way, then sometimes it is very, very hard to say what is the right thing to do in these situations. Usually beings like to live. Usually even human beings, even when they get very old and sick, they prefer to be alive. That's kind of the nature of beings. And it's the same is probably also generally true for animals, but not always true. So you do your best to feel out what is the what seems to be right at a particular time. And if you do decide that an animal, it is the right time for the animal to die, it is not going to be a very bad karma on your part. You're trying your best to do what is right for the animal, and as long as you're trying your very best, the karma is not going to be very bad. You're not doing it because you are angry, you're not doing it because you are greedy or whatever. You may be a little bit of delusion because you don't fully understand the animal, but it's going to be a very, very small amount. So it's like grey karma. It's neither bad nor good. It's somewhere in between because you're trying your best. So I wouldn't worry too much about these sort of things. It doesn't weigh very heavily on your balance sheet, nor on your karma balance sheet, nor is it going to be, very bad or very good for the animal itself. So I think it is one of those things. As long as you are sensitive, careful, and do it with a sense of a good heart and wisdom, you're not going to go very far wrong in these kind of areas. So I hope that helps. Next one. Would you like to add anything, Venerable? Are you okay with that? Yeah? Good enough? Okay, good enough. Okay. Dear Ajahn, question number one. This is always very tricky. You get one piece of paper, but then you have three questions or whatever on one piece of paper. It's very, very smart, very, very sneaky. Sorry? That's a good point. So you say, that's probably the reason to save papers. You have 10 questions there, another 10 on the back. Yeah. Dear Ajahn, is one who is in deep samadhi experiencing an out-of-body experience? that is an interesting question. In a sense, it is. In a sense, you are having an out-of-body experience in the sense that the body is gone. So you actually know what it is like to not have a body. This is the kind of experience you have in samadhi. It's similar to the kind of experience you have if you are reborn in the very high Brahma Loka or something like that. Yeah, body is gone, senses are gone. So in a sense, it is an out-of-body experience. But it is an out-of-body experience of a particular kind. Yeah, there are other out-of-body experiences. The more normal kind of out-of-body experience is not like this. This is a very profound out-of-body experience. The more normal ones are not as profound as this. A normal out-of-body experience is like when you are on the operating table, you are dying, and you come out of your body. That kind of out-of-body experience is not fully an out-of-body experience because you still have a body. Yeah, out-of-body experience like that, you have a body, but it's of a more fine material. You still see yourself pretty much as you did before, but it's a slightly different kind of body. You haven't fully left behind the five senses and the body yet. So it's a very good. That's actually a very good question. Thank you for that. I like that one. So there are different levels in a sense of leaving the body behind. When you get to deep samadhi jhana, you leave the body behind in a much more fundamental and absolute sense than the normal outer body experiences. Where you still have a physical body. It's explained in the suttas. It's explained as if you have a snake or a straw. If you have a straw, you can pull another straw from inside of it. Yeah, and it's like the sheath on the outside comes off, and the inner straw looks very much like the outer one. It's very similar. Yeah, or a snake. The skin, outer skin comes off, and the inner snake is pretty much the same as the other one. In the same way, when you pull your mind out of this body, you get another body which looks pretty much similar. This is the ordinary out-of-body experience. But in samadhi, it's a much more profound thing. If yes, what is it that is out of the body? Well, it is only out of the body in the sense that the body, you don't experience the body anymore. It's the mind that is out of the body. Yeah, it is the mind is the is you have a pure experience of mind because you have distilled it from the body. It is taken out of the body. All the five senses and the physical body are gone. This is the first time you have a pure mental experience. So now you know what the mind is. Like an experiment, when you want to find out what something is, you have to separate it out from other things. And when you see it by itself alone, then you know what that thing is. And this is what you're happening when you do. When you have this kind of samadhi experience. So it's the mind.
Is that called Nirodha Samapatti?
No, that is not Nirodha, because Nirodha, also the mind, is also gone. Yeah, so Nirodha Samapatti is in the sutras called Sanya Vidayata Nirodha in the sutras. It's called Nirodha Samapatti in the commentaries. But that is when everything is gone.
Everything is
fine. Everything is gone. There's nothing left. The mind is gone too. Here the mind is still there. In Samadhi you still have a mind. You still feel, you still experience, you're still conscious. In Nirodha Samapatti, everything is gone. Blank. Nothing. That's the difference.
Yeah, there's some story that, you know, some monk, he will tell people that he will be going for like 7 days doing Nirodha Samapatti.
Yeah.
And his body is just there. And he told people not to touch or not to do anything with the body. And he's just gone, you know, for 7 days, and then back. It's just
it's a true story. It's from the sutras.
It's a real case.
But yeah, true. But it's also in the sutras. So the real cases in the sutras, they should match up. If they don't match up, you have a problem. So that matches up. You know the story in the sutra?
Which one?
The story in the sutra. The story. Yeah, it's in the Marva Tajaniya Sutta Majjhimanikaya 50. It's a story of Mahamoggallona in a past life. He was Mara in a past life. You know that story? Yeah. There's a story in there about one of the disciples of the past Buddha. And this disciple, he was a very good meditator. He could enter Nirodha Samapatti. Sanya Vidayata Nirodha is called in the suttas. So he was sitting in the forest. And he was sitting there, but when you go into Nirodha, you become so still. Everything is gone. There's no breath. There's nothing. You're absolutely still. It looks like you're dead. It looks like you're dead. Yeah, no, absolutely still. So these two men that come by, who are they're collecting firewood. Firewood collectors. Yeah, and they see this monk in the forest. They're collecting firewood. They've got this big bunch of firewood. They think, this monk is dead. Yeah, we better make a big pile of fire and burn him up and cremate him because he's dead. So they make this big pile of wood. They put the monk on top. They light the fire. And then when they see the fire is going well, they leave. The next morning, what happens? They go into the village. In the morning, they give alms to the monks. Yeah, so kind of all the monks come in, and so they give alms to the monks. And suddenly, they give alms to this monk, and they wonder, who is this? And they look up. That is the monk they were burning yesterday. Because the story is that if you go into Nirodha Samapatti, Sanya Vidayata Nirodha, you cannot do anything with the body. The body is preserved regardless of what you do. So even if you try to burn it, nothing happens. According to the story, nothing can happen to the robes. So when you come out, when the fire is gone, and you come out Nirodha Samapatti, oops, you just kind of brush off the ashes of your robe, and then you walk back into the village, and you continue. That's the story. Is it true? I don't know, but
I tried it.
So this is supposedly possible to do. Yeah, 7 days, go into Nirodha Samapatti. So this happens. But this kind of samadhi attainment is so profound that everything stops. Your mind stops. Yeah, your mind is gone. So how do you know that it happened if your mind is gone? How do you know that you attained an experience of complete cessation? If your mind is gone, how can you know it happened? What do you think?
I don't know.
It's interesting, isn't it? So this is a little bit beyond this question, but anyway, it's the way you know, yeah? The way you know is that as you enter the attainment, everything becomes more and more peaceful, more and more quiet, until eventually you reach the boundary of what is possible to be conscious of. And then, blank, nothing here. So you can see the movement towards complete cessation. And then on the other side, when you come out of this, the very first thought, the very first consciousness you have is the most refined consciousness possible. And then gradually you come out of it. So you know it by inference. You cannot know it directly because you're not there. There's nothing there. But you know it by inference. You can see the movement of the mind moving towards cessation. Then it ceases and then it comes out on the other side. Anyway.
No, just, you know, interesting.
Interesting. Mm. Very interesting, yeah. So I think it's possible. But that's Nirodha.
I heard many cases, you know, some monks, they did that.
Mm-hmm.
And then no, if anybody touch the body, then he'll be dead.
That's not what it says in the sutta.
But is this the real case?
Mm-hmm.
It is. If anybody touch it before he comes back,
uh-huh.
the mind come back, then he will be dead.
Uh-huh.
So then, you know,
okay.
everything, his room will be closed.
How do you know it will be dead? How do you know? Did you try?
Well, that is a story also.
Yeah.
If somebody, you know, didn't listen to what, you know, so they touched the body and just died.
Okay. Okay, interesting. Okay, well, thank you for that. Okay, let's move on to the next question here. Okay. Dear Ajahn, is practicing compassion a purely mental thought, or has it to be followed by action, compassion and action, like what was being done by Su Chi Foundation here? With many of these things on the Buddhist path, it is actually more important to do it in practice than do it just in mind, yeah? Because the practice is actually where you learn it. That's when it becomes, we kind of lay in the basic foundations for these things. It's like doing metta meditation. All you do is metta, may all beings be well, may all beings be happy. And sometimes it doesn't work, and sometimes you nod off or something. Sometimes it doesn't really work. Yeah? We try these things, it doesn't have a power. So metta practice should always start off with doing these things in action. Yeah, metta in speech, metta in body. That's how the Buddha explained these things. And then metta in thought. Just, you know, actually wishing other people well. Just not even doing meditation, but just wishing people well in daily life. Thinking kind thoughts of other people. Not thinking harsh thoughts and all of these things. So that is where metta should start. And if you start with that, then when eventually you come to your meditation cushion, you sit down and you do your meditation, then it works, yeah, because you have laid down the foundation for all of these things. So very important to lay down the foundation. And it's exactly the same thing with compassion as well. Same idea. We start off with compassion in daily life, and there's lots of opportunities with that. Compassion and metta, there's also enormous number of opportunities to do little acts of kindness in life. And as long as you take those opportunities whenever you can, then you are doing the right thing. So please do that. And people often, this is so useful for many reasons, because it leads you to being able to do these things in meditation, but also because you're building up your general levels of kindness, you're making good karma, you're making yourself feel better, and you're doing things that you know will work. These things are actually possible to do, whereas these other things are much more subtle and difficult. And one of the things that always, I found so interesting when I asked some of the greatest meditation teachers around, and I met some very remarkable meditation teachers over the years, and you asked them, you know, how to practice metta, and they will often give you a very simple answer. These are the people who might be arahants, yeah, in the world, who might be fully awakened or whatever, and they say, well, if you want to practice metta, just ask yourself when you wake up in the morning, what can I do for the world today? How can I add something to the world rather than subtract something? So metta is about how we act moment to moment, the ability to act with kindness in general. That's what it is about. And compassion is the same way. So when you see suffering, you want to alleviate the suffering and help other people. No? Okay, you're happy? Okay, good. Yeah. Very good. Okay. Next one. Dear Ajahn, why are some monastics allowed to eat food like cheese, seaweed and dark chocolate? Why are some of them allowed to do this? Because they have a special allowance. Is that it? No, there is. You will always. This is kind of strange about the monastic rules. Is that you will never find two monastics who practice the rules in exactly the same way. And the reason for that is because there is it's a matter of interpretation. Yeah, the rules aren't 100% kind of finalized. It's not possible to know exactly what they mean. So there will be minor differences in how people practice, and that's okay. It doesn't matter as long as there are small things. It's not so important. What really matters is that the monastics keep the big rules, the rules that really are important. That is what matters, and that one should really be concerned about. So the reason why some people eat cheese in the afternoon is because that was a standard in the Thai forest tradition. The Thai forest tradition, Ajahn Mun, who was kind of one of the forefathers of that tradition, he thought cheese was equivalent to a Pali word called Navanitang. Navanitang is one of the five allowable requisites in the afternoon for monastics. And so he thought Navanitang is cheese. He didn't know what cheese was. He was from Thailand. The cheese is a Western food. Yeah, it doesn't really exist in Asia. So he had never seen it before. This looks like Navanitang. So okay, let's call it Navanitang. But he didn't really know. Yeah, it's not a Thai food. Cheese doesn't really exist in Thailand. Now it does, because now everything is so international. But not in those days. So whether cheese is Navanitang or not is very questionable. Yeah, and many people will say no. Some people say yes, and other people say that. And for lay people, don't worry too much about it. Yeah, it's not a big deal whether some people have a bit of cheese in the afternoon. In our monastery in Perth, we don't actually have cheese in the afternoon. But Ajahn Brahm, sometimes when you go outside the monastery, you do. And if you're offered cheese, you may have cheese in the afternoon outside the monastery. We don't have any very kind of clear, final decision on whether it's allowable. Ajahn Brahm reckons it's allowable, but there are good grounds either way. Seaweed, I don't know about seaweed, never heard of any monks who have seaweed in the afternoon. Never heard about that. Not sure about that one, don't know about that one. Dark chocolate, well, dark chocolate is because it is a combination of allowable items or allowable ingredients. So you have like five ingredients that are called the five tonics, yeah? Besadja in Pali. And these five tonics are sugar, honey, ghee. Ghee is like something made out of milk or whatever, yeah? And then you have Navanitang, I just mentioned before, and then you have oil. So chocolate is like oil. It is sugar. And then you have cocoa, and cocoa is a lifetime medicine in Pali. It's like a coffee and tea and cocoa. They are like called lifetime medicines. You can have them anytime you want. So this is like kind of the technicalities of the monastic code, the monastic vinaya. So it's just matters of interpretation, yeah, and that's why never expect two monastics to practice exactly the same way, then you won't have so many. And it's just, you know, there's no need really for all monastics to practice the same. It's actually impossible. It's never going to happen because there isn't any final word on these things. Also, Venerable Ratapala's way of getting his parents' permission to ordain is almost the same as Venerable Sudina. It is actually the same, yeah? As described in the first vinaya rule. Are they the same person, or is it simply a coincidence? Thank you. Indeed, that is a good question, and I think many people will say that they are, in fact, the same person. It's the same story that has been used in two different places. And one of those is more likely to be original than the other one. And I think most scholars take the Ratapala Sutta to be the more original one and consider the Sudina story in the first Parajika Vinaya rule to be a later adaptation of that one, so to have a background story for Parajika 1. But it is uncertain, so it is very likely to be the same story because it is basically word for word the same all the way. It did exactly the same thing, and it's kind of a unique story in that way. So that's a good observation, and this is often what you find in these in the suttas and the vinaya. You find stories kind of being used again like that. Okay, dear Ajahn, in meditation, when joy arises, do we observe it as a feeling, or can we enjoy it by riding on the feeling? When joy arises, basically, you don't. What you do ideally, depending on how deep that joy is, you continue with the breath. The breath should be the anchor of your meditation practice. Yeah, so stay with the breath. The breath is there. The joy is there. And then you, if you watch the breath in the right way, and it keeps on calming down, the joy gradually becomes more powerful there. And really, it's hard to say. Sometimes it can also go with a feeling. It's also possible. For example, you do metta practice. You may not even do mindfulness of breathing at all. So it's also possible to do these things via just purely by feeling. But normally at this stage, the breath is still prominent enough. You can keep going with the breath. So you have the joy, you have the breath, and then you allow everything to calm down. And it's really only when you come to the nimitta stage, when you see bright lights or whatever, that is where the breath tends to fade away much more, and it goes more into the background. And then you kind of change your object to the nimitta, yeah, and you don't actually worry so much about the breath anymore, even though it may still be there very faintly in the background somewhere. Yeah. So, but you know, that this doesn't mean you don't enjoy the joy. Please enjoy the joy. Yeah. Enjoy is enough with one word there almost. So just enjoy it, because that is a very important part of the meditation practice, to enjoy this. But without getting too attached, right? Otherwise, you have a problem in the future. Okay, so I hope that makes sense. So let's get on to the next one. Dear Ajahn, can you please clarify for us about the Dhamma being shortened by 500 years because the Buddha started the nun's order? Oh, that was, yeah. And Venerable Ananda pleaded to him 3 times before he agreed to do it. Thank you. Okay. P.S. There are still participants here who have listened. Okay. So, this is an interesting thing, yeah, and what actually is going on there about the when this happens, and the Buddha says to Venerable Ananda that yes, he will agree to start the nun's order, because Venerable Ananda said, well, nuns have the same ability to attain awakening stage and all of these kind of things as monks have, so because of that there's a good reason to have nuns. Yeah, why shouldn't the nuns be given that opportunity? And of course it's good to have women being given the same opportunity as men. And as I mentioned before, some people regard the Buddha as the first feminist, yeah, because he allowed women a roughly equal status as men in the Sangha. And that's kind of nice. I think that's a very nice thing. Yeah. But this whole thing about the whole sasana, or the Buddha's teaching, being reduced in lifetime because of the ordination of women, there's been a lot of scholarly research on that, and there is a lot of uncertainty as to whether this really is historically correct or not. And when you read the whole story, it does seem a little bit strange. The Buddha says, okay, we will now ordain women, and the next thing he says, okay, but now the sasana will only last for 500 years. So what is it doing? Is it really supportive of women, or is it not? You start to wonder, you know, why is it kind of undermining, apparently, the women's order pretty much straight away after he has agreed to ordain them. And in one way, to me, the story does not seem very, very plausible. To me, it just sounds a little bit strange. And I think a lot of people who do comparative studies of this particular sutta and this particular passage with other suttas have come to the conclusion that quite possibly it was not written by the Buddha, but it may have been something that was included in this at a later stage. And this is always a possibility. Remember, these are narratives. This is not the word of the... this actually happens to be in the spoke in the word of the Buddha, but it has a kind of narrative context to it. But one of the things that it does say, which is interesting, let's say the Buddha did say that now it's only going to last for 500 years. He still allowed women to ordain. That is kind of the astonishing thing. If he really thought it was going to be detrimental to Buddhism, and he still allowed women to become nuns, he must have thought it was incredibly important. So you can turn that whole thing on its head and say, actually, ordaining women was so important that even if it kind of reduced the life of the sasana, still it needed to be done. That's another way of looking at it. But I think it is unlikely to be the case. I think it is more likely that the Buddha didn't do that. He wouldn't want to harm his sasana. He would have tried to find a way to do this so that it was possible without harming the Sangha and the future of Buddhism. So I personally doubt whether it is true. There's no way of knowing absolutely for sure with these things. All you can do is come to approximate understandings. And the Venerable Ananda's plea out to him three times before he agreed to do it. That's true. He was kind of, it seemed to have been reluctant, and it seemed to have taken a while before it actually happened. It is hard to know exactly what was going on there. One of the interesting things that has been pointed out by Venerable Analayo, who is one of the great scholars of these things, he has said that when you read the various versions of this story, versions in Chinese translation especially, they often have a different sequence to these things, different things happening. So for example, one of the things that happened in that version, in the Chinese version, was that initially the Buddha said, I think he said that for the women, for Mahaprajapati Gautami, who was his foster mother, to actually practice at home rather than become monastics first of all. So started off practicing at home because it was considered too dangerous for women to live an ordinary ascetic life. You can imagine just living in the forest by yourself can be pretty daunting, especially in ancient India if you're a woman. It can be quite dangerous. So he said basically there it was a matter of protection. Yeah. So you have to wait until the situation is right in the Sangha so we can make sure that the order of bhikkhunis is properly looked after before we start ordaining them. You can't ordain someone when there is no support, when there is no cutis for them. There's lacking the kind of the standards that are required to make it viable. And that seems to be coming out of one of the Chinese versions of this particular story, or a couple of them. So you can see how it depends on which origin story you read. The exact historical sequence of things basically is uncertain and too unreliable to draw any conclusions. What we do know that the Buddha did ordain women, so it must have been an important thing to do. Yeah, that's what we do know. The rest of the story, I think, is much more uncertain and more unreliable. Huh? Anyway. Yes? No? Maybe? Huh? What do you think? Yeah? Venerable, you should answer this question, not me. Huh?
Well, just like what you said, many scholar, you know, have different opinion, but more likely we, the Pikuni, we can think that many things that said about the Pikuni is added later.
Absolutely.
On.
Yeah.
Yeah, not the Buddha, you know, intended. Probably, you know, those senior monks that didn't like the Pikuni. You know, and then the one that who passed on, you know, the teaching from generation to generation, so they can put in, you know, the words that they wanted to. So that, but what you said has been Ananda had to ask three times, right? And then the Buddha agreed, because Indian society, even nowadays, the woman, most women in you know, in the village, in the small village, not in the city, the woman stay home, and the men go out to work. Still, in a Buddhist city like you know, Buddhagaya and Savatthi and things like that. I walk around in the village. The women stay home still, and the men go to work. And if you think about 2000 and, you know, some years, those women be out of the picture, you know, right? Because the culture, the restraint, the Buddha That's why the Buddha hesitate to ordain woman. Once the woman ordain, and then they will leave, they will stay separately from home. It will be more, you know, dangerous, right? If we live alone and apart from the family, from the men, and you know, for protection, things like that. I think the main reason why the Buddha, you know, hesitate to ordain woman is for the safety of the after woman ordained, will be difficult life. Even nowadays, you know, the bhikkhuni still live not as well as the bhikkhus. Yeah. Well, people still, because of, you know, the bhikkhus order rooted for how many thousand years already. But the bhikkhuni, we just started less than 20 years. So we need, you know, to do a lot of work to build up, you know, for the people to have the confidence in us, have faith in us, and then, you know, then later then they will support us. But eventually, you know, eventually the bhikkhunis and the bhikkhu will be just about, you know, left hand and right hand in the future. But eventually it will take time, but,
yeah,
you know, but it will grow. And if you guys support us, then you know, it will be growing faster. But here in Malaysia, bhikkhuni very few, only two or three, right? In Thailand now, we have about Samanarian bhikkhuni about 200, and it's growing. You know, maybe women ordain. Get come to ordain more and more. But in Sri Lanka, they have a lot. They ordain every year and
several thousands in Sri Lanka. Yeah,
many thousand. But in the Sri Lankan tradition, the woman they were 10 precepts before. They call that's
a Sila Mata.
That's a Sila Mata. I mean, yeah. There are 10 precepts. They're wearing the robe, but with no ganda. Just one big piece of cloth, but no ganda like the monk or bhikkhuni. But the color is more like yellow, not white like Thai Mechi. The 8 precepts, they wear white, but in Sri Lanka, they wear yellow. Yellow or some brown, so it, you know, in the distance it will be just like what the monk would wear, or some orange color. So it's not much different. But in Thailand, those 8 precepts only wear white, right? But so when they see the woman wearing this color, they will look.
Oh.
You know, at first. Because I've been ordained many years now. At first, when we travel around, people just stare at us, and they will look, you know, you a woman, you a man, why you wearing this robe? But now people are more familiar with us. They know, you know, who we are, and so we don't have much trouble. But in certain area like in the northeast, where Chan Chai is, around that area, there's a bhikkhuni in Khon Kaen, in the northeast area, and the chief of the village, he came with the villagers to chase her, you know, away. Yeah.
Really? Okay.
After the Katina, just this past Katina, I went. After we all finished, it's the Katina from the royal family.
Yeah.
And after all the Katina finished, and then we all went back, and she said that the head of the village with the villager came and tried to, you know, chase her away. But she called the police.
Uh-huh.
So but she called the police, and the police came, and she told the story, you know, the land is given to her by a, you know, village.
Okay.
Yeah. And she told the story to the police, and the police got me, you know, mediate. Then they all went back.
Okay, good. It's good that she takes proper action, you know, that's good. Okay.
Yeah, in some part it's still, the people are still, you know, again, some part of the country.
Mm.
Like in the south, in certain province, even the natives, yeah, there's a Pikuni, she's in the country, Thammarat, and she grew up there, and she was trying to set up her center, and she got kicked out.
Mm.
Yeah, so she has to move to another city.
Okay. Mm. Okay. Hardships of being a Bikuni. Yeah, not easy. Okay. Yeah. But I think one of the things about ancient Indian society was not very friendly towards women. So
right.
A lot of the reason why these rules came into the Vinaya is because of the pressures from society. Mm-hmm. It wasn't necessarily that the monks were super duper anti bhikkhuni or whatever. It's just that it was a general society feeling, and for that reason, a lot of these rules were added. And we know that because the rules for the bhikkhunis, they vary so enormously between the different traditions. So it's fairly clear that many of them came a long time after the Buddha. So that is perfectly, I agree perfectly with that. Okay, good. So let's move on to the next one. There's only a couple of questions left. Dear Ajahn, I am very inspired by forest monks who are able to meditate in such scary conditions. May I know how to overcome those fears? The way to overcome these fears is to have deep meditation practice. Yeah? The deeper your meditation is, the less fear you're going to have. And the reason is because you identify more and more with the mind. You're not so concerned about the physical body anymore. When you go into a jhana state, because you give up the body completely, you don't really care about the body anymore. The body is irrelevant. You identify fully with the mind. And if you die, okay, it's fine, it doesn't matter. Yeah, death is no problem. When you die, you probably go to a really nice rebirth afterwards anyway. Nothing to worry about. Yeah. So this is kind of the this is how you do that. You don't not worried because your meditation is already deep. And there isn't really much point in going to the forest or going to a scary place unless your meditation already is deep. That is a place you go to deepen your meditation further. There's an interesting story in the suttas where Venerable Upali goes to the Buddha and he says, "The Buddha, I would like to go into the forest to meditate by myself. Can you, excuse me, please give me a teaching?" And the Buddha says to him that you should wait till you can see the four jhanas in yourself. Only when you see the four jhanas in yourself should you go into solitude and practice by yourself. So in other words, you stay in a place that is fairly safe, like a monastery, like maybe the BGF, maybe, or whatever it is. This is quite nice and safe, isn't it? So you stay here, and then you learn how to kind of get your meditation together. And then when you really are having meditation together, that is when you go and really stay in the forest by yourself. Like some of those forest monks in Sri Lanka or Thailand or wherever it is that are very inspiring. It is precisely because they have deep meditation that they are able to do that. Then you have no fear. But you can't really expect to let go of your fear fully until you get deep meditation, because that is when you let go of the body, you identify with the mind, and then it doesn't matter so much anymore. But generally speaking, if you have a happy mind, if you have a good mind state, and you feel good about yourself, then death does not seem so scary. Yeah, because you kind of know that the future is safe. Yeah, if you feel good inside, you know that the future is going to be looked after when you die anyway. Nothing so much to worry about. But if you have a mind that is not so good, not so bright and light and all of these things, then of course the future is more uncertain. It depends on all kind of factors, what happens afterwards. And that is why it is more scary at that particular stage. Okay, so one blank question there. Okay. Goodness. So this is the metta for ping tong. Okay. So okay, I hope that is close enough, and then we can do some chanting for the person who is in hospital with stroke. No problems. Is there any further questions, or before we call it a day? And if more questions or comments by anyone? Yes, sir.
You said, I forgot the state, and then you use inference, because then when you say you use inference, it's after you come out of it, is it?
Mm.
When you're in it, you know it.
You don't know anything because everything is gone.
Then it's like, what, death?
I know, death, you are still there. Yeah, that's the difference.
You
death, you're not gone. This is like you really are absolutely gone. Consciousness, the mind stops. The mind stops, and then it stopped for a few hours or 7 days, and then it starts again.
God. So, I don't get it. So, there's things there, but this one has nothing.
Nothing, yeah. Nothing. Not even nothing. Yeah, nothing you can experience, but this is actually beyond nothing. It's stopping. Ceasing.
Okay, so the inference is after that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But this is like super duper profound. Yeah, it's like. So, Yeah. It is maybe. I think something like it. Yeah, it's maybe if you want something that is maybe similar, it is kind of a little bit similar, but it's much more profound than that. Yeah, deep sleep. Sometimes you come out, you're very nicely rested. The next morning, you feel really good because you're well rested. But in deep sleep, there's still things going on. There's still, if you wake someone up in deep sleep, and you ask them what's happening, there's still some very subtle dreams usually going on, even in the deepest of sleep. Usually, yeah. You can't remember it because they're very subtle. So if you wait till the morning, you can't remember it. But if you wake them up in the middle of the night, they've done experiments on this apparently, and apparently you still dream. Yeah, it's not just the REM, rapid eye movement state that you dream. Apparently you dream all the time. So the mind is still going, but it's kind of very subtle at that particular point. So it's much more profound than that. And when you come out of Nirodha Samapatti, you are incredibly clear. This is one of the things that you know something very profound has happened. Your mind has become, this is the deepest kind of peace you can have. Actually, you don't even have the peace because nobody has it, but the deepest kind of peace. And because of that, when you come out, your faculties are super duper sharp. Yeah, everything is sharper than ever before. You're very clear mind. Everything is more clear. Even when you come out of a jhana, you are very clear. This is even much more clear than that again. Huh? So this is how you know something has happened. Yeah, you don't know what because you weren't there, but something very profound has happened. The time has really passed really quickly. 7 days gone by like that. There's a nice story. This is a nice story about a Chinese master, empty cloud. You've heard about empty cloud? Xu Yin, yeah. A very, very famous Chinese monk who lived, he was born back in the 1840s, 1860s or something like that. And he was one of the most famous monks in China in the modern era. One of his disciples was a monk who started the City of 10,000 Buddhas in San Francisco later on. And he died a few years ago. That was his disciple. And he was very famous as a meditation master. And apparently he was, one day he was offered a meal. Yeah. He said, "Oh, venerable sir, you know, meal." So he accepted the meal, and then he said to himself, "Oh, I'm just going to do a bit of meditation first before I eat." Yeah, so he went into meditation, And he went so deep. After 7 days, he came out. And the meal was all moldy and green. He couldn't eat it, anymore. Yeah. That's one of those amazing stories. Yeah. And he was the kind of character that you might believe. Maybe he could do such things. Sometimes these are stories. It's very hard to know how true they are. But it is possible that they are true. And it fits with what can possibly be done in the suttas. Yes.
Yes, Ajahn. Many years ago, I went to a retreat, and it was focusing on rising, falling of the abdomen. So now, when I do the breathing, I sort of sometimes get a bit confused.
Yeah.
What's your advice?
It's okay. You can do that. I kind of like Ajahn Brahm's technique, where you just know that the breath is going in and out. You don't really focus on any particular area of the body. But focusing on the abdomen is okay, yeah? I mean, the Pali word, the Pali phrase is Padimukkang Satting Upadapetva. So, and that does not mean the abdomen. If it means anything, it means kind of in front of you, yeah? In your vicinity right here and now, Padimukkang. Yeah? So it's more likely just to mean in front of you in a general sense. But it is mindfulness of breathing, and I think it probably doesn't matter all that much, but just have a general awareness. Are you breathing in? Are you breathing out? Don't connect it to any part on the body. This is not body contemplation. Yeah, this is not physical body contemplation. It's a breath contemplation specifically. So just stay with the breath. Don't do anything else. People say, feel it here, feel it there, but actually forget about the body altogether. It is possible to know whether you're breathing in or whether you're breathing out without tying it down to any part of the body. So try that. Yeah, but there isn't any final right or wrong. You know, if you feel the breath in the abdomen, if you feel it in the nostrils or the upper lip or whatever, all of these things are okay, especially as long as you're making progress. If you stop making progress, that is when it is better to kind of to recalibrate a little bit and ask yourself, is there something else I should be doing here? So, yeah. Is that helpful? Huh? Yeah? Okay. Very good. Huh? Okay. Anyone else want to say anything here? Everyone is happy here? Yeah? Are you happy? Yeah? Okay. Okay, good. Let's just pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and then we can call it a day here.